You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. On December 5th, the IEA hosted a debate at our offices, asking if economist and author John Mills had the solution to the UK's economic problems. At the heart of John's plan is a proposal to lift the share of manufacturing and investment by engineering a substantial fall in the exchange rate. On the other side of the debate was the IEA's chief economist, Julian Jessop, arguing that deregulation and lower tax rates are the best way to stimulate economic growth. Both John and Julian join me for today's podcast as we go over the main points made during the debate and go into further detail in regards to areas of disagreement and consensus. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out our podcast channel, IEA Conversations. John, can you give us a summary of the points you made at the debate about the biggest problems you feel are facing the UK economically?
Well, I think the British economy suffers from at least five major problems at the moment. One is our rate of investment is incredibly low compared to the world average. And even more important, we're not investing in technology and mechanisation and power, which really are the things that drive productivity increases. Secondly, we've deindustrialised, so we can't pay our way in the world. Thirdly, we've got a huge balance of payments problem, which is really unsustainable at nearly 6% of GDP. Per annum. We're borrowing money right, left and centre to finance this gap or selling off assets all the time to make good the balance of payments deficit we've got. And what growth we have got is driven by consumption, it's being driven by the QE and asset realisation. It's not been driven by investment and exports as it should be. And until we rectify these problems, we're never going to get the economy to grow properly.
Julian, do you concur with any of that?
Well, I certainly agree that the recent growth performance of the UK hasn't been great. And in particular, I think there are some valid concerns about the weakness of productivity and related to that, the weakness of real incomes. But I think John is a little bit too pessimistic about the recent past. I think there's every chance that productivity will pick up of its own accord over the next few years as the labour market continues to tighten. Low productivity has been the flip side of big gains in employment that are probably now coming to an end. I also think that the fact that we have a relatively low rate of investment in this country is partly a reflection of the structure of the economy. For example, we are a more services-based economy. It may well be that productivity gains in services are harder to measure than those in manufacturing, but ultimately I think they could prove just as beneficial to the population as a whole.
John?
Well, I think that's a very optimistic scenario. If you look at what actually drives economic growth right across the world, it really isn't services. It's very largely manufacturing and it's very largely the application, as I said earlier on, of mechanisation and technology and power. I mean, some of that can be applied in the service sector, but it is really light industry and manufacturing which are the home of these sorts of investment returns. And because we've allowed the economy to shift so far away from manufacturing to services, down from about 30% in 1980 to less than 10% now, I think this is the main reason why productivity is so slow in growing.
John, do you think that's been an active choice on the part of different governments, or is that just the way that the world is moving away from traditional manufacturing and more into the digital sphere and the technological sphere?
Well, I think what's happened is a real world shift, which means that the whole of the Western world really is doing poorly compared to the East. And I think what happened was that when inflation took over in the 1970s and 1980s, there was a huge shift towards neoliberalism and monetarism. And what this did do, it fought down the inflation quite well. But the flip side was that no attention was paid to what happened to the exchange rate, which went up and up and up. And as a result of this, we just deindustrialized to a point where we've got this incredibly lopsided economy. And this is why I think that getting the exchange rate down to some more reasonable level is the prime move we ought to make to get things right.
Julian, does John have a point there that without certain levels of industrialization, you're always going to lack in productivity and in quality jobs for a certain part of the population?
Well, that's certainly been the case in the past. John is absolutely right that the big gains in productivity have traditionally come in manufacturing and in other heavy industries. But I wonder whether that's going to continue to be true in future, in particular as new technology rolls out into new sectors, into services sectors. There's I think, a lot of scope for big gains in productivity there. So partly this is a question of looking forward rather than rather than looking back. I think there are undoubtedly some factors holding back UK manufacturing, and these would include high levels of government intervention, taxes and so on that are the discouraging innovation. But I wouldn't put the level of the exchange rate very high on that list. Arguably, the exchange rate has actually fallen significantly on most measures over the last 10, 20, 30 years without that necessarily being the solution to the weakness of manufacturing.
John? Well, I just don't think that's right. I think that the real exchange rate has gone up enormously since the 1970s. And it's no coincidence that manufacturing started to decline when that happened. And I think that the real reason why investment is so low is because the high exchange rate means large sections of it that we really need are just not profitable. And if it's not profitable, it won't happen. I think it is very profitable in the Far East, which is why investment is so high, and it's not profitable here, which is why investment is so low.
Julian, is there an issue with investment just fundamentally not being profitable at the moment?
Well, there are certainly things holding back companies from investing, but I think a lot of these are actually temporary rather than structural. So, for example, there's the uncertainty around the outcome of the talks between the UK and the EU over our terms of departure. I think that if we can get some form of deal with the rest of the European Union, then there's potential for investment to pick up quite sharply over the next couple of years. After all, a lot of companies are sitting on quite healthy cash balances that they could eventually put to work. So I think to some extent the weakness in investment is temporary. But I also suggest that to the extent that investment is relatively low in the UK, it's more because of problems of the way that the government runs the economy rather than because of the level of the exchange rate. I'd add also that in the process of getting the exchange rate down, we might create some benefits to the economy, but also potentially some costs. For example, increased inflation, which could add to the squeeze on real wages we've seen from a weaker pound over the last year or two.
Well, I'm not sure that's right. If you look at the record over the last 40 years, on the whole, the British economy has become more and more deregulated and liberalised. We've had a greater and greater concentration of globalisation. And at the same time, investment has gone down. It's not that investment has been low for a long time. It's not the case. It's fallen significantly over the recent period.
It's true that investment is relatively low in the UK as a share of GDP, but actually that hasn't changed much. It doesn't, for example, explain the relative weakness of measured productivity since the global financial crisis. And I'd like to come back to this point also about how we would get the exchange rate down if indeed that is the solution to Britain's problems. I think it's very hard to see how you can actually do that. And even if you can do it, how will you keep the real exchange rate down? In other words, how will you prevent the benefit of a lower exchange rate being eroded by higher inflation? I know there have been episodes in the past where the UK has been able to pull off that trick. For example, when Sterling left the ERM in 1992. But that was a situation when the exchange rate was clearly fundamentally overvalued to begin with, when interest rates were very high to defend that exchange rate. And above all, when there are lots of spare resources in the economy that could be put to work without creating inflation. I'd argue that isn't the situation now. The exchange rate is basically back in real effective exchange rate terms, in other words, relative to our trading partners, to roughly where it was in 1992, which was when the last time the balance of payments deficit was at a fairly small level of roughly 2 to 3% of GDP. And we have an economy that is close to full employment. So I would be concerned that a policy of managing the exchange rate down, even if that could be done, would simply lead to higher inflation rather than more jobs.
We've spoken quite a bit about the problems facing the UK economy. John, what are some of the direct solutions you'd like to see implemented tomorrow?
Well, I think that what we could do would be to get the rate of growth in this country up to somewhere like 3 or 4% per annum. I think we could get investment up from less than 16% of GDP per annum up to more than 20%. I think you wouldn't have to pay a significant inflationary price for all this, but what you would be able to do is to increase real wages. And I think that this is really incredibly important, not only economically and socially, but also just in terms of where the world is going. I mean, if we're running the economy in a way which doesn't produce any real benefit in terms of increased wages for very large sections of the population, how long is it going to be before we get more political parties coming up in favour of protectionism and moving away from the rules-based international trading arrangements we have and all this sort of thing, the sort of values that the Institute of Economic Affairs values so highly. And my concern really is that if we can't get these fundamental problems in the UK economy sorted out, there's just going to be a movement away towards more policies which I would regard as irrational and ineffective. And that seems to be the last thing we want to do.
Julian, do you agree with John's assessment of what the problems are? And what would your policy solutions be to fix them?
Well, I certainly agree with John's assessment of what the risks are. I think there is a danger that if the current economic model is perceived to be failing, then people reach for alternatives that actually might be counterproductive. So we're already seeing a lurch towards the left, not only in the Labour Party, but arguably in the Conservative Party as well, with lots of talk of greater regulation of prices and incomes and the economy more generally. So I certainly can share John's concerns about the risks. I don't, though, quite share either his diagnosis of the depth of the underlying problem or many of his solution. Looking, for example, at real wages, I mean, it is true that the aggregate, the average data, do suggest that real wages are lower now than they were before the financial crisis. But that's a measure that's fraught with all sorts of statistical difficulties. It's distorted, for example, by compositional effects. There have been a lot of older people who tend to be higher paid who've retired from the labour market. That's depressed the average. And a lot of lower skilled people who tend to be lower paid who've got jobs during the economic recovery. Again, that depresses the average, but arguably it's no bad thing. It's better for somebody to be in work than out of it. I suspect over the next few years, we will actually see productivity recover. The squeeze on real wages will fade as nominal wages pick up and inflation drops back next year. And also, as far as the solutions are concerned, I don't think a big fall in the exchange rate would be a major plus. I think it would be better to concentrate on continuing to deregulate the economy, continuing to cut taxes. Those are the sorts of things that I think would have a much better effect on lifting the barriers to innovation and investment.
John, what do you believe is the role of government at this time when it comes to investment, when it comes to central planning? Does the government need to be more involved, less involved in getting economic growth up?
Well, if you look at what's happening nowadays, I think there are strong tendencies on the kind of left of the political spectrum to reach out for supply side remedies to all this, more finance for industry, more training, more infrastructure expenditure. On the right, you've got a rather different agenda of more deregulation and more globalization and so on. And I just don't think either of these sorts of remedies are going to move the dial to any significant extent at all. I think we've tried and tried and tried these, and they don't really, really work. And I come back to what I was saying earlier on. I don't think they deal with a really fundamental problem, which is that if you can't make the sort of investment that we need profitable, it just won't happen. And the real problem that we've had over the last 40 years, really, is that it hasn't been profitable to invest in manufacturing in the UK. We've deindustrialized as a result. And the mess we're in, which is really unsustainable, I mean, we cannot go on living at nearly 6% beyond our mean with a huge balance of payments problem. We can't go on borrowing as a government and as a nation and as consumers the way we are. You know, we're in a situation which is just not viable in the long term, and we need to find changes that are going to put it right. And really what I'm offering is at least a solution that I think is a reasonable chance of working.
Julian?
Well, I'd agree with John that a consistent balance of payments deficit of 6 or 7% of GDP is not sustainable. But I believe ultimately it will be self-correcting. The number of ways of different looking at this, but one way is to say that the balance of payments deficit is basically the mirror image of the financial positions of the corporate sector, the household sector, and the government. If the household sector starts saving more money over the next few years as real incomes recover, and if the government continues or rather reasserts fiscal discipline, then that'll help the balance of payments on that side. But also, if it is indeed the case that these sorts of balance of payments deficits are unsustainable, then the markets eventually will create correct the value of the exchange rate on their own. I mean, after all, the value of the pound did fall quite sharply after the Brexit vote because the markets took the view, wrongly as it happens in my view, but they took the view that the UK economy is going to be significantly worse off in the long run because of the prospect of leaving the European Union. If the markets decide that actually they don't want to continue funding this deficit, then the exchange rate will fall without the need for the government to do anything.
One area where I think I'm hearing overlap is the issue of the deficit. John, why is it not clear to more politicians across the political spectrum that the continuation of spending is going to come back and create far more problems down the road than they're trying to solve now?
Well, I think to some extent it's crept up on us. I mean, the balance of payments deficit and the amount of borrowing that the government's doing, I mean, the government debt has fallen a bit recently, but that's really been offset by more borrowing by consumers and by the business world. I mean, this instability is still there. The fundamental instability comes from the balance of payments deficit, and that's just got larger over the last few years. And is now becoming just increasingly unsustainable. I mean, I don't think we should run a balance of payments surplus, but I do think that if you don't run a balance of payments deficit, which as a percentage of GDP is less than the growth rate, you are then inevitably going to have the real debt in relation to GDP going up and up and up. And I just don't think that's sustainable.
Well, John and I absolutely agree that the key to getting real wages up over the longer term is to boost Britain's productivity performance. And it's very important, clearly, that we do that before the next economic downturn, so that household balance sheets are in a better shape, people have a bit of more of a cushion of savings in particular. The debate is about the best means to do that and the role that a weaker exchange rate may or may not play. My concern is that a weaker exchange rate at a time when you're already close to full employment is actually going to only increase inflation and therefore add to the squeeze on real wages and mean that people save less rather than more. So I'm not sure in this context that a weaker exchange rate is the solution.
John?
Well, when I was at university, I was taught that when you had a devaluation, you would automatically have more inflation. And when I looked at a number of devaluations have taken since the war, I think somewhere around about 15 altogether, what I found was a pattern which was quite different. Sometimes you had more inflation, sometimes you had less. Most of the time it was more or less the same. But in no case that I could find anywhere was the inflation sufficiently large, the extra inflation sufficiently large to wash out the extra benefit in competitiveness that you had from a lower exchange rate. And going back to what Julian was saying just now, I mean, if we have got a balance of payments deficit which is unsustainably large and the markets turn, why do the markets think that a lower exchange rate is going to make things better if that's not true? Now, I think actually what we ought to be doing is preempting the markets by doing something to rectify the situation before the roof falls in. And that's why I think that a policy which is planned to get the economy more competitive has to be the right way to go.
Well, I think that there's no doubt that a weaker exchange rate will result in a smaller balance of payments deficit. I mean, that is economics 101. So I don't think that's something that either myself or John or the markets would disagree with. I think the markets at the moment, though, are taking the view that they are happy to continue accumulating UK assets because we are an open, dynamic economy. I know that it... political uncertainty is at the forefront now, but you know, compared to many parts of the world, we are considered a safe haven. And we are relatively welcoming to foreign investors, whether that's in our property market or in our companies. So I think the markets are taking the view that they're happy to see the UK continue to run a balance of payments deficit because UK assets are things that they want to hold. There may well come a point in the future where that isn't the case, in which case the pound will have to fall to a more attractive level to continue to attract that capital or to keep it here. But that'll be a self-correcting mechanism, I believe, that the market can drive rather than politicians trying to preempt that.
Well, the only thing I would say against that is that if you look around the world, there are loads of countries that do, in fact, operate the sort of economic policies in terms of the exchange rate that I'm recommending. They don't just wait for markets to have an effect. You look at South Korea, you look at China, you look at Germany, you look at Switzerland, you look at Japan. All these countries are very different. All of them have got large constituencies, particularly their manufacturing sectors, which believe that they need competitive exchange rates to continue to prosper. We're quite different here. We've got a sort of governing class which is very orientated towards London, very orientated towards the service sector, which doesn't really believe in the efficacy of exchange rates in dealing with manufacturing. But unfortunately, services don't pay the rent in terms of export earnings. They're relatively small and difficult to increase, whereas what really is much more flexible in terms of its volumes are manufactured exports, and that's where we're failing.
Julian?
Well, I think it's good that John is talking about how other countries approach their exchange rates. I think there's a bit of a generalisation in there, though. So, for example, Germany, I think, is actually an economy that's done reasonably well with a relatively strong exchange rate. It's sort of provided additional discipline on the German corporate sector to remain productive. But there is a more general point here. The risk that a policy of competitive devaluation by the UK is simply a beggar my neighbour policy. We benefit largely to the extent that other countries are made worse off. And from a free market point of view, it may well be that a devaluation is good for the UK economy. But thinking at this from a sort of global perspective, if that simply makes other countries, our European US competitors, for example, worse off, that's not necessarily something I'd want to advocate. It is possible that there are some asymmetries here that a devaluation could correct. So as John hinted at earlier, Asia tends to run large current account surpluses, which are sucking demand out of the West. But if that's the problem, then what is required is a general devaluation of all of the Western currencies against the Asian currencies, rather than a policy that particularly favours a weaker pound.
I must say, I would agree with that. I mean, I think that is the real problem, that the whole of the West, the United States, the UK, and probably the European Union as well, has got an overvalued currency in relation to China and Indonesia and these other countries. And I think that's, in the big scheme of things, what needs to be rectified. But if you look at the UK, we're a real outlier on this. I mean, we've got a bigger balance of payments deficit than any other major country in the world. And so we are in a real pressing position to get something done to rectify this, and other people are. And, you know, I know that we've got international obligations not to get involved in currency wars, and I think that's absolutely right. What I don't think we can do is to go on having a deficit which is far, far larger than the rate of growth of the economy, which therefore inevitably means that in the end it's going to be unsustainable.
Julian, if you had to choose between devaluing currency and opting for a aggressive industrial strategy led centrally, which would you go for?
Well, obviously I'd find neither option attractive, but actually I would prefer in those circumstances to devalue the currency rather than the government stepping in to decide which sectors to support and where best to invest large amounts of other people's money. The advantage of devaluing the currency in that context is that it is changing a price. It's therefore going to change the incentives facing particular players in the private sector, but it'll be those players that decide how best to benefit from that, where they want to invest, what they want to do to take advantage of the increased competitiveness that the UK economy might be benefiting from. So if it's a straight choice between devaluing the currency and a more activist industrial policy, I think I'll go for devaluing the currency. But I still think there are better ways of achieving the objectives than either of those.
Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt at all about the fact is that what is in fact a market-driven approach on all this, which is devaluing the currency, is far more effective than either more deregulation and more competition on the one hand, or industrial strategies on the other. And I think that there's a danger that if we resort to either of the latter two, that's industrial strategies or more competition and so on, more deregulation, that you finish up by leaving large sections of the population really alienated from the ruling elite in this country, that you finish up then with populist parties coming to the fore, irrational policies in my book on protectionism and so forth. So I think one of the really important things, and this I would share this with the IEA, of the importance of having a rule-based international trading framework, of having on the whole market-driven solutions to problems rather than ones run by the state. And I think the danger is that if we can't get some sort of synthesis between growth that Keynes formulated when the discipline that was introduced by monetarism and neoliberalism, the danger is that we lose the battle and finish up with state interference, which just doesn't work.
For more blogs, podcasts, films and reports, visit our website at iea.org.uk.